Case number 19-1236 et al. Kentucky Municipal Energy Agency et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Norani for the municipal petitioners. Mr. Clement for the Louisville Gas and Electric Company and Kentucky Utilities Company petitioners. Mr. Ettinger for the respondents.
All right, Mr. Norani, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Latif Norani for the municipal petitioners. I've requested 2 minutes of time for rebuttal. As a result of FERC's orders on review, rates to the city of Frankfort, Kentucky have gone up by millions of dollars. The people of Berea, Kentucky have limited competitive options to choose from when replacing their soon expiring power supply arrangement. These harms to rates and to competition are precisely the harms that FERC was required to consider when making a public interest determination pursuant to rate schedule 402. If FERC refused to consider the rate impact, and it lacked sufficient evidence to assess the competitive impacts. Let's look at the competitive impacts first. Usually, FERC evaluates competitive harm following the DOJ guidelines by testing for market concentration. And here we know the market is already highly concentrated and repancaking rates will increase concentration beyond FERC's own thresholds. As the dissenting commissioner pointed out, the market concentration test suggests that the municipals will have limited access to competitive supply during critical periods. But FERC adopted a new test here. Will there be a sufficient number of competitive suppliers after rates are repancaked? Now, FERC said it considered three factors taken together to make this sufficient number finding. And under this court's precedent, if it finds any one of those factors deficient, it must remand. So what are the factors? First, there's a few dozen suppliers that responded to energy agency solicitation when rates were still de-pancaked. As the dissenting commissioner pointed out, that just shows that de-pancaking achieved its purpose of promoting competition. The question that FERC asked is how many of these suppliers would have been competitive without de-pancaking? And on that, the record is silent.
I thought it wasn't silent because in fact you had a number of power sources outside MISO that are obviously not affected by the deep pancaking rule.
Right. So FERC noted this 65% of energy agencies' power is coming from resources inside MISO. There's exactly three resources. Right? It's not a large number. It's three resources. One is owned by Paducah. One is owned by the city of Paris. The other is a old unit, the Joppa unit, which is great. It was a fire sale deal because it was already set to expire this year. So when they purchased the output from that plant, they knew this was like a short-term gig that they could get, and that plant was going to go out of service very soon. So they took that fire sale deal, but that plant's going out of service imminently. So really, there was only three suppliers, two of which were their own, and one was this mothballed plant. So that's all the evidence there is, like there's three suppliers. And more importantly, even though 65% of energy agency power was coming from inside resources, Princeton and Paducah have 100% of their resources coming from outside from MISO. Owensboro has 100% of its resources coming from MISO. And Berea and Benham, who are former requirements customers, also have 100% of their power coming from MISO. Three is not sufficient.
Did you argue that, all of those details, to FERC? In your original argument and a rehearing?
I believe so. I mean, I think, I can find the citations for you. But on rehearing, you pointed out why the 65% number wasn't relevant.
Well, I mean, I meant the one about the fire sale one that's going out of operation.
Yeah, I think I recall a footnote. I'll find it for you on rebuttal. But I recall a footnote in our rehearing brief that listed out with citations to the record where those plans are.
Can I take you back to what you said at the beginning with respect to Section 203 and the Commission's public interest regulations? Commission interprets them to require them to consider only the public interest factor underlying the mitigation measure, in this case, horizontal competition. So that's the Commission's interpretation of the statute to which we owe it deference and its own regulation to which we owe it even more deference. So what's your best argument for us disagreeing with the commission about that?
So I think the plain text of the statute, the plain text of the regulation that articulates these factors disagrees with FERC's interpretation. But more importantly, FERC's own precedent disagrees with it.
Explain that, would you please?
Sure. So if you look at the text of the regulation, says, this is 2.26.
It says the commission will generally consider the following factors, right?
In addition to others.
But it says generally. It doesn't say it has to. It says it will generally consider these. If I say I will generally consider three things, it means I'll generally consider them, but I might not. And the commission has said, in circumstances like this, we're only going to consider the condition that led to the mitigating factor in the first place.
The commission
we give heavy deference to the commission in terms of interpreting its own regulations. So I haven't seen in your brief or heard from you yet what basis we have for second guessing that.
So I would say first that this is, in the contract, the parties expected, at the time they entered into the agreement, the parties expected that FERC would follow what it always had followed, that it considers these the relevant factors in the public interest. Now, this is the first time FERC has ever had a factor before it and not considered it. Right? So all the cases FERC cites for its history of only considering the original mitigation factor were cases that didn't have protests or cases where the protests were addressing different issues. And in all of those cases, FERC addressed the issues that were raised before it, right? So I think FERC's refusal to address an issue that was raised before it is the real problem.
Or it said it's a general, they've said we'll generally consider it and it was raised. We don't have to decide one or the other. It's you have those two combinations together. Should they have either addressed it or explained why not? Is that your position? You're saying that you argued it and that's the real problem, but you were saying before it was the regulation and the regulation says we'll do it. I'm just asking why it's not the two of those things together. You don't have to take those apart.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think you have to take them apart. I think it is both.
Can I ask about your non-MISO purchase power agreements and that you wanted to have pancaking for sort of the backup or economy energy from within MISO? How is that workable? How will they even know if you're obtaining energy from within MISO that it is backup or economy energy as opposed to simply extra contracts within MISO? I don't even understand how that's administrable, your proposed position.
Right. It could be difficult to administer, absent the fact that we've already reserved 100 megawatts of transmission. So the Energy Agency reserved that transmission.
I'm talking about the backup power purchase.
Yes, that's right.
Transmission reservations are different than purchase power agreements, correct?
Correct. And so...
Are the backups, yes, are they subject to existing contracts? You have those contracts, right?
So there are some contracts now. Some of it is market energy that is bought in spot market. Some of it is pursuant to, option agreements. But the backup and economy energy agreements were not entered into before March 2019. So those backup agreements are not part of the transition mechanism. The question Judge Millett asked is, how would you know if a particular transaction, a particular power purchase is for backup or economy energy? And I would say, if it comes over this reservation that was made for that purpose, any power that comes over that transmission reservation, we can presume is for backup and economy energy, because that's why we purchased the reservation.
So the reservation isn't going to be used for other power?
Right now it's used.
The transmission reservation now is only used for that? That seems an odd, you have all this transmission, you have a lot of transmission, the power in reserve, transmission reservations there, and you're telling me the only things they would ever be used for is for backup or economy energy?
Yes, I am saying that because there's another 100 megawatt reservation mm-hmm. that is tied directly to a contract from Big Rivers. And similarly for Princeton and Paducah, mm-hmm. they reserve these transmission, when they make a power purchase agreement, they reserve specific transmission for it. Right. And when they have economy energy, which is most of it, on this particular 100 megawatt transmission, that's the reason it was entered into, was for economy and backup purchases. And it's not that much.
It still doesn't tell. How do they know? I mean, I get that contract for economy energy, for example, is going to go over that transmission reservation, but that still doesn't, you're going to use that transmission authority to or ability to get that energy to you, but that still doesn't police whether in fact that really was an economy energy that was a backup for your alternative energy, as opposed to, hey, we just want to get this energy into our system. I'm still not getting how it gets policed, right?
Right. So the policing part of it is, so you know, if I were establishing the standard, I would say that it is presumed that anything coming over this particular pipe, there's other pipes too, new ones that are not part of the transition mechanism, but anything coming over this particular pipe is presumed to be for backup and economy energy for these resources.
Does someone rebut that presumption? How would Louisville rebut that presumption?
So
is a shorthand for that really long
acronym. Louisville Gas is fine. When Louisville Gas, there's what are known as E-tags, right, which record the sink and the source, the origin and the destination of every power purchase. So every time power is brought over.
No, I get that it's coming to you. That's all that seems.
This is my ignorance of the process.
You're getting it. You're getting over your transmission reservation. You're using your backup or economy energy contract for it. But it may be that your outside MISO source is doing just great. You just wanted some extra energy because there's a heat wave or for some other reason. I don't know how they can police that it's really being used as you just needed more energy as opposed to it's your economy energy.
Right. And so the tag that that comes along with the import, it says what the source of the power is. So I think Louisville Gas could use that tag to police and rebut the presumption that power brought over this pipe is not for economy energy. Or as Your Honor mentioned, that they could look at the load. They could see that, you know, you're bringing power in, your diesel units are running and your Paducah unit is running and the sun is shining and you're still importing power, they might be able to rebut the presumption. So there's lots of ways they could rebut that presumption, I would say, if they were trying to police it. But there's also no reason to think that the energy agency would abuse this.
And then your the hydropower agreement that you have, there's some parts of the record describe it as ownership. Others treat it as just a power purchase agreement. Is there an ownership interest in there? Investment or ownership interest of some sort? For 50 years is an awfully long time.
Yeah, it's the hydro contracts are, is an owner, my understanding is it's an ownership interest of a sort, but the plants are actually owned by American Municipal Power and Princeton and Paducah are participants in the project. And so the exact financing and like legal ownership, I'm not sure how that works exactly. Mm-hmm. I know that Princeton and Paducah are participants in this project, which is owned by American Municipal Power.
Why was it reasonable for FERC to treat, it's effectively, and I'm just going to use a shorthand, I understand your qualifications, but effectively an ownership interest, and getting power through an ownership interest, which involves so much more money and so much more potential use and control over process, the same as a plain old arm's length power purchase agreement. Can you tell me why it was reasonable and where in the record they explained why that would be reasonable?
So it's reasonable because an ownership interest is more of a reliance interest than a mere power purchase agreement. So it's if you're considering reliance interests, right, then the reliance interest in buying something and issuing bonds backed by your citizens is actually a really big interest. So that is, I think, the logic for why that should be the case. And I will say that if you look-
FERC didn't seem to be, finish your point.
In the rehearing order, the 2019 rehearing or September 2019, FERC clarified that it wasn't, that all long-term binding financial commitments do count. So FERC, the test that FERC established both in March 2019 and then in clarification in September was this principle of binding financial commitments that are long-term. And an ownership interest is exactly that. So that's the principle FERC established. Nobody contested that principle. The question is only the application of the principle.
I just have, if you bear with me, I have one last question. Sure. So it's applied to Prairie State, which is your own sort of generating, it's a source for generation of power. It's owned by you. What can the deep handcaking provision there be used not just to provide power to Princeton and Paducah, but if you also wanted to send that money through the same transmission system and then off to other Prairie State customers? The deep handcaking would apply just the same, I take it. There's no, you don't have to, the deep handcaking isn't limited to providing power to Princeton and Paducah. It would apply to the extent you're also using this to send power elsewhere.
Under the transition mechanism, that wouldn't be permitted, right? So under the transition mechanism is clear that you are only allowed to use it to deliver power to the cities.
For the city's use?
Yes, for the city's use. And I think the bond provisions, because they're municipal bonds, I don't even think they're allowed to sell it to, as far as I know, I don't think under municipal bonds, you have to be using them for public purpose. But Princeton and Paducah use this power, right? They, mm-hmm. they match their load to the imports all the time.
Do they use more Prairie State power than, I mean, does the investment interest in there allow you to obtain more power from Prairie than Princeton and Paducah need and it goes elsewhere? Or is that all the interest, all the ownership interest is limited to? Because it seems like it's producing a lot more power than these two little towns could ever use.
Sure, but these two little towns are only a small portion of the ownership of the full unit, right? Mm-hmm. So, but the only power that's being imported into Kentucky from Prairie mm-hmm. State is for Princeton and Paducah. Okay. None of the other cities in Kentucky have rights to it, and Princeton and Paducah wouldn't sell. There's no contract okay. for Princeton and Paducah to sell that to any other okay. Kentucky entity.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Clement, we'll hear from you if you'd unmute yourself.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Paul Clement for LG&E, and I also would endeavor to save 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case has its origins in a 1998 merger where FERC identified competitive concerns in one and only one market, the market for KU requirement customers. Princeton and Paducah were never in that market. They were TVA requirements customers in 1998, and as of early 2005, they informed TVA that they were withdrawing in favor of their investment in Prairie States, and that would thereafter serve their needs. By that point, LG&E had announced already its intent to withdraw from MISO. As part of that process in 2006, LGE agreed with both customers in the requirements markets and others potentially affected by LG&E's MISO withdrawal to a FERC-approved schedule, Schedule 402, that de-pancaked certain transmission charges. Nothing in that schedule promised that it would last in perpetuity or that contracts entered in reliance on it would be grandfathered. To the contrary, the schedule itself made clear that it could be revisited as market conditions changed. And change they did. Indeed, so much has changed in the ensuing 24 years that the concerns that motivated FERC in 1998 that a requirements market limited to a handful of players would lose one of those players are unrecognizable today. Today, FERC estimates that roughly 100 suppliers could compete in that same market. For that reason, FERC sensibly concluded that de-pancaking is no longer needed to mitigate market power concerns in the only market in which FERC ever identified any such concerns. Thus, it bears emphasis that FERC concluded that no de-pancaking measures remain necessary for competitive concerns today. None. FERC did not find that such measures would be unnecessary in 5 years, or unnecessary in 10 years, or unnecessary in 35 years. They found they were unnecessary today. And so that leaves only the question of accounting for the reasonable reliance interests of those who have relied on the notion that the de-pancaking measures would continue in place. Given the massive changes in the market and the express provisions for modifying Schedule 402, any reliance interests are somewhat questionable. But with respect to the just negotiated power purchase agreements with relatively short tails of 2 to 7 years by those participating directly in the market that was the focus of FERC's concerns, LG&E does not take issue with the modest grandfathering associated with those agreements. But extending the grandfathering to investment decisions made years earlier and lasting decades longer by parties who have never been in the requirements market is a fundamentally different matter. Princeton and Paducah have never participated in the market that was the sole concern for FERC's competitive concerns.
Are you disputing the facts, the fact of their reliance that FERC found, or are you accepting that FERC found as a matter of fact they had relied and reasonably in its view, and you're arguing some legal prohibition that it was arbitrary and capricious for FERC to have made the call that it did?
All of the above, Your Honor. I mean, we really had three sets of arguments when it came to Princeton and Paducah. One is that there was no reliance in fact. Two, that any reliance would have been unreasonable as a matter of law. And then third, that even if you accept those, that the grandfathering went on too long.
Right. So as to your middle one, I mean, facts are very hard to say there's not substantial evidence for on this record, given the thing. I mean, I don't need to recite to you what FERC already said about that with respect to Paducah and Princeton and Prairie State. But as to
because I do think that if you look carefully at what FERC did, we're not actually suggesting that they sort of got the facts wrong. What they said, we said they didn't rely on fact. And in response, we did that in our rehearing petition. And what FERC said in response was they reasonably relied, you know, based on the 2019, based on the schedule being in place. So we were making a factual argument. They didn't rely on fact. And the response we got was, well, it would have been reasonable.
They have said in their decision that, look, after de-pancaking came in, that's when they sort of jumped in with both feet to this investment, just as a matter of fact. That's when they really jumped in. And so that showed factual reliance.
With respect, Your Honor, I think that's what my friends, the municipal interveners, have argued. I don't actually read FERC as finding that. And in all events, I think as a matter of fact, the facts are pretty clear that even before the de-pancaking schedule was issued, the folks at Princeton and Paducah had already committed irrevocably $800,000 as their initial investment and millions of dollars in additional ongoing payments.
No, but they gave up after the de-pancaking, they gave up an ability to sort of get out of the contract, right?
They finalized it. They finalized after that.
They gave up a right to get out of it, right?
They did, Your Honor, but here's what's missing. There's no internal document at Princeton and Paducah that says in making this investment decision, we are relying on the fact that these de-pancaking will be in place and will last forever. And that's what's so unrealistic. And Your Honor's own questions sort of drew this distinction between the investment decisions and the ordinary power purchase agreements. And I think part of the reason that those should be treated differently gets back to the questions of reliance in fact and reasonable reliance. because with respect to the power purchase agreements, these are recently entered agreements, and they're going to be in place for 2 to 7 years longer. The last one of those expires in 2029. So in the context of that agreement, to say you're going to rely on the current regulatory environment, that seems reasonable. But when you're making an investment decision that's going to have a tail that lasts to 2057 in the case of the hydro plants, or potentially even longer with respect to prairie states, the idea that you reasonably relied on the current regulatory climate remaining in place, and that if FERC ever changed it, they would grandfather you, that's not a reasonable reliance. I mean, there's no reason the Schedule 4-
You seem to accept that it's a reasonable reliance for a certain period of time, because you're not contesting grandfathering for, what is it, I think it up to 10 years? Some of them on yours, or is it 10 or 20? I forget what the other ones are, but the power purchase agreements, you're not contesting that as being reasonable.
We're not contesting that, but there's two differences there. The longest one, the longest tail is 7 years.
Right.
So 2029.
And no, I know, but you seem to be making a general argument that you can't reasonably rely on this regulatory scheme staying in place. And of course they can. Your argument is a time that it's not reasonable after a certain amount of time.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, I think there is another difference between Princeton and Paducah and the other municipals for which they entered the power purchase agreements that we don't contest. And that is, the other purchases were people who were always in the requirements market. And for those people, they may have had a different sort of reliance interest, because it's relatively unusual for a merger mitigation agreement to be changed. It's possible, but that's more than an ordinary sort of rate. With respect to Princeton and Paducah, they were included in Schedule 402, not because they were in the requirements market, but simply because they might have had a regulatory ability to protest the decision of LG&E to withdraw from the MISO in 2006. And that's different in character, because there are plenty of FERC cases, including the Columbia Gas case and the Northern Pipeline case that we cite in our papers, where when you're talking about normal rates subject to revision under 205, that there are no reliance interests whatsoever. So, and that's different from the entities that were in the requirements market, who are really the core people who would be subject to the 203 review. And so we draw at the outset, we have an argument that basically says for Princeton and Paducah, they had no reasonable reliance interests. And then we have our second argument, which is, in all events, even if they had some reasonable reliance interests, because those were investment decisions with very long tails, the idea that they would have a reasonable reliance interest in the entirety of the tail is categorically different from the people who are in the requirements market and had much shorter tails. And so you create this situation where you have something of like a double irony here. The people who were furthest removed from the core concerns of the merger mitigation condition are the ones that are benefiting for the longest period of grandfather. And I mean, just to put this in clear terms, like, you know, I will have my 91st birthday and Princeton and Paducah will still be enjoying grandfathering under the hydro plants. That's what it means to extend it all the way to 2057. So the idea that you're taking a rational condition on a 1998 merger, and in 2019, FERC has determined that it no longer is necessary for market conditions at all today, no longer. And then you're going to extend it to 2057. That is not a rational balancing of kind of reliance concerns on the one hand and getting us back to a regulatory regime that makes sense on the other. That skews the balance entirely in favor of reliance interests. And of course, FERC itself recognized that in the context of Prairie States.
Didn't Schedule 402, and I'm sorry, I can't find the spot right now, but Schedule 402, which was approved by FERC, talk about, maybe it was the approval order. One of them talked about not just pre-existing requirements, but also protecting future, use the word future requirements customers?
I don't know about that particular language where it is, Your Honor, but I mean, you gotta look at, you know, obviously the schedule as a whole. And one of the things that the schedule specifically does is it provides a mechanism for it being revised. And I suppose the parties could have built right in there the idea that, and when we revise it, all existing contracts will be grandfathered, but it doesn't say that either. So the idea that you're going to rely reasonably for 50 years in making an investment decision.
We know about 50 years, but for some time period, right? We have to look at that, right? I mean, you're for Princeton and Paducah, you're saying no reliance at all, zero time period. Isn't that your position?
I am. And the reason I'm saying that is because with respect to them, they're not in the market that FERC is concerned about. So they are in Schedule 402. I don't want to be misunderstood. They're in there, but they got in there for a different reason. They got in there because they had potential regulatory objections, not competitive objections, to LGE withdrawing from the MISO in 2006. I mean, one way you can just sort of feel the difference is in 1998, Princeton and Paducah did not object to the merger. They had no business objecting to it because they weren't in the requirements market. In 2006, they have a regulatory objection to Princeton and LG&E withdrawing from the MISO. And that is part of what's resolved in Schedule 402. But with respect to them, it's not any different.
It's done against a statement that is sort of essentially recognizing that FERC wants deep pancaking now. Might change in the future at some point, but this you knew this was what you're going to have to do to get out of MISO.
Sure.
So this been for some time period. I'm not saying not, but for some time period.
And it's already been way over a decade, which is the normal length of a lot of other merger mitigation conditions. And we're not asking to retroactively get our payments back.
No. But all right. So they were in, and covering them was something that your clients thought they were going to have to do to get FERC. For the first request got rejected. You're going to have to do this to get approved to get this withdrawal from MISO. So many layers to this case approved was have this rate 405, 402. Have this rate schedule. Sorry, the schedule. There and it was going to have to include these folks, right?
Sure.
Perry and Princeton and Paducah. All right, and then so now the question is, when Congress, when the commission said, all right, now we're going to undo that, even the deep pancaking that we had in Schedule 402, protecting the reliance interests of folks in Schedule 402. Is what FERC seemed to require. I think that seems to be the easiest thing. MISO to 402 and 402 to deep pancaking was protecting the interests of even those entities that were in Schedule 402 that might not have been original merger. The original requirements customers that were being protected from the original merger. It went beyond that by Schedule 402, and then the deep pancaking is protecting the same folks and the same interests that were protected by Schedule 402. And so that leap from they weren't there at the time of the merger, they're not an original requirements customer, that's all FERC can look at, seems to ignore this evolution, which in the course of it recognize a protection both for existing and future requirements customers.
But let me try one more time, Your Honor, because what I'm saying is, yes, they were in 402. But if the way to think about this, I think, is that with respect to the original requirements customers, they were in 402 because of concerns that trace back to the 1998 merger. On the other hand, Princeton and Paducah are in 402 because of concerns that are really limited to regulatory concerns about LG&E's withdrawal from MISO. Mm-hmm. And the reason that distinction is important is because there's plenty of FERC precedent that says when it's an ordinary contractual tariff, you may have made, as a party who's benefiting from that tariff, you may have made investment decisions, you've made purchase agreements, you may have made decisions based on that tariff being in place. And generally speaking, FERC doesn't care.
Right, but generally, Schedule 402 is not an ordinary contract, right? You can say it's not the same as the original contracts requirement, original requirements customers, and maybe they're somewhere in between, but they're not, this was not the same as a plain old contract. And in fact, there's the line in there about we think we got to do this because otherwise FERC isn't going to sign off because it's in a heavy de-pancaking mode right now. Obviously, that's a paraphrase, but that language is in there. And so we have to wrestle with that.
So with respect, Your Honor, I think that with respect to the Princeton and Paducah and the other transmission customers who were never in the requirements market, it is an ordinary contract. It's a contract that was entered in part because they had the ability to raise regulatory objections to our withdrawal. We had answers. Nobody knew how we, you know, if we would win or they would win in a regulatory fight over that. So we agreed between ourselves that we're going to, you know, we're going to have a settlement here and we're going to have this contract that we're going to enter with FERC and FERC is going to approve. That actually the original version of it was just with these entities outside the requirements contract. Didn't say anything about 203. It was, you know, and that was added only when these two things got sort of mushed together. I mean, one way of thinking about this, Your Honor, is Schedule 402 really has sort of two groups in it. And with respect to the groups that are in it because of competitive concerns that date back to the 1998 merger, it's a pretty unusual animal. And therefore, we're more willing to accept a modest degree of grandfathering associated with these power purchase agreements with relatively short tails.
Well, that's one way. That's one way of looking at it. But another way is that, yes, they talked at the original merger, time of the merger agreement, they said, we are very concerned about existing requirements customers. But when FERC is worried about competition, it's not exclusively existing competition. There's also forward-looking concerns about competition. It's just not in that moment. It's also forward-looking. And what Schedule 402 did, and when FERC signed off on it, and it's, I think, JA 267, is where they use that word future. They include within the people that are going to be subject to de-pancaking their future requirements customers. And so they made more explicit there what would have been, I think, had to have been part of their concern with the original merger agreement is not just protecting these exist list of existing requirements customers, but competition itself and its forward-looking aspects. So future requirements customers too. And that's what carried forward in Schedule 402. So that's just why, to me, it feels like Schedule 402 doesn't fall within your ordinary contract. Like, there's a separate argument you have about how long. I get that, but I'm just trying to look narrowly at this. Do we treat them? How are they to be considered?
But here's the thing, Your Honor. I may not be persuading you, but I want to take one last try at it, which is Princeton and Paducah were never in that requirements market. They are transmission customers of ours. That's a different market. Mm-hmm. FERC looked at that market back in 1998, looked at all the different markets. It didn't have any concerns with that market back there. Its concern was the requirements market. And Princeton and Paducah have never been in that market. They were TVA customers at the time, so they were wholly removed from it. And then they made a decision in early 2005 to basically supply themselves with Prairie States. So their benefit from Schedule 402 really is essentially collateral. It's, you know, this would be an easier case for me, I suppose, if what my clients did back in the day was have Schedule 402 that was just for the requirements customer and Schedule 403 or 402 prime that was for these individuals. But there is a difference. They were in there for a different reason. And I think that informs their reliance interest. But if I can move to the second piece just very briefly, I'm over my time, obviously. But I do think you're right. I do have an argument about the length of the reliance. And I think even if somebody who was in the core requirements market was saying that they're entitled to a grandfather that extends to 2057 because it was an investment decision, I would be saying that's unreasonable. I mean, there aren't any of those. The people who were in
if it weren't an investment decision, if it were just for some reason, a plain contract that went for 50 something years. Would your position be different?
My bottom line position would be the same. My argument, I think, would be this much weaker. But I just think,
tell me how investment when they say, look, that whatever it is, we're only using it as to Princeton and Paducah, we're only using it for power, just like a plain old power purchase agreement. Why should we think about investments differently? Or where did FERC go wrong in treating investments the same as regular arm's length power purchase agreements?
Well, I think ultimately the key is that, and this is why I'd be making roughly the same argument, even if it were a anomalous power purchase agreement with a 35-year tail. But I think investment decisions tend to have long tails. Purchase power agreements tend to have relatively shorter tails. So that's in the nature of them. And if you're an agency trying to figure out how do I manage reliance concerns, and I, you know, and should I give a grandfather? Should I give a partial grandfather? Should I give no grandfather? To treat, even apart from their investment versus non-investment nature, to treat an agreement with a 50-year tail the same way as an agreement with a 2-year tail is inherently arbitrary and capricious on both of the factors they purport to be considering. They purport to be balancing reliance interests versus kind of getting us to the current market environment where we don't need these. And I think on the first prong, it's just not rational when you're making a 50-year time horizon investment to make the investment on the assumption that the regulatory climate isn't going to change for 50 years. These are people in this industry. Anyone in this industry who's been alive for the last 22 years knows that things can change radically over a decade or two.
Is there anything
is
there a place in the record that says what the average length of a power purchase agreement is? Because I couldn't find it.
I don't think that's in the record, Your Honor.
It seems kind of relevant to this argument.
I actually don't think it is because, I mean, you know, FERC's dealing with the situation it has in front of it. And it has, so even if there's a theoretical possibility for a power purchase agreement to last sort of 20 years or 25 years, if there were one of those here, we might have objected to grandfathering that one and not all the 2 to 7 year ones. But that's not the record we have here. We have a record that has a bunch of short-tailed power purchase agreements and some long or almost infinity-tailed investment decisions. Nobody has suggested that that's atypical of power purchase agreements on the one hand or investment agreements.
I think there is a 20-year contract in the record that was grandfathered. I thought I saw a reference to 20. I think that's the highest number I saw other than the hydropower.
My understanding of the record, Your Honor, the longest one that is grandfathered, putting aside the Princeton and Paducahs, are to 2029. So that's only 7 more years. Okay. So there's a huge difference between that. I mean, there's not a huge difference between that and 10 years, which is kind of the compromise on prairie states. Mm-hmm. But then there is a huge difference between that and the hydro contract.
Sure. Okay.
If I could say one last thing about the 10 years on prairie states.
If you'd wind it up, please.
Sure. I would just say that to apply simply the 10-year standard that's used as an initial merger condition to that investment contract without making an adjustment for the fact that this is not an initial merger mitigation condition and FERC has already agreed that there's no need for these conditions, I think as a market condition, is I think arbitrary and capricious. That's all I'll say on that. I appreciate the court's indulgence.
All right, thank you. Mr. Ettinger.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Thank you, may it please the court. I'm Scott Ettinger for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and thank you for hearing the case today. Judge Millett, I want to go to some of your questions. You mentioned the rate schedule 402, and it's in the record at JA 557, and I think you were alluding to this, and I just want to highlight this fact that there is a provision, Romanet 5, which talks about changes to the mitigation. And if you look at the definitions 2 pages before that, the MMD parties are defined to include the TVA distributor group, which includes Paducah and Princeton. And several lines above that, this contract explains that the mitigation in this contract is intended to shield the requirements customers from any repancaking of rates. But it also extends to the MMD parties, which, as I just said, includes Princeton and Paducah. So reading—
And any future customers.
Requirements customers. But reading these three together, if we then turn to JA559, which talks about changes, that really reads the mitigation described in this section for Princeton and Paducah is intended to implement the section 203.
Sorry, you've got to take a second to catch up to your site. 559, is that last one you said?
Right, JA559.
Yep, sorry. I'll make sure I have the right one in front of me. Okay. And I'm sorry, can you make your point?
I'm looking at the bottom of that page, Romanet 5.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's intended to implement the merger agreement itself.
Right, and that includes Princeton and Paducah explicitly through the definition of MMD party on JA557.
The commission original merger decision, they're at least confirming there maybe what wasn't made so explicit in 98, that they were looking not just at the existing requirements customers, but also potential future customers.
Right. I'd point, Your Honor, to the 2020 rehearing order, paragraph 4, paragraph 35. This is at JA 358. And the commission finds that it was—
sorry, can you give me your site one more time?
Yeah, JA 358.
You're very good at moving through these.
As fast sorry. As you.
No, you're better than me, so I'm slow. What page again?
JA 358. And that's—
did you say the 35? Did you say the 2020? Okay, I'm on the wrong 2020 order.
The 2020 rehearing order.
Got it. Okay.
And this is where the commission explains that utilities have a fundamental understanding of what the transition mechanism is intended to do. It's not whether they were in the market at the time of the merger, but whether they were in the market at the time of the March 2019 mitigation order and had relied. And I guess the point I'd like to make here, Your Honor, and this is going back to your question, is when the commission conditioned the merger on membership and MISO, it wasn't just MISO for the request. Anyone who would have connected to the system would be able to enjoy whatever benefits flow from membership in MISO. So it, even if it wasn't exactly stated at that time, those benefits would have been available to anyone. And the utility's argument here seems to be, well, the commission could make a merger condition, but no one can rely on it. And I would just submit that doesn't seem to be much of a mitigation at all.
I take that point, but I also, to be fair to their point, at least one of their points, they have a lot of points, is you can't rely on it for 5 decades. And that does seem, and I get you say, well, we just looked at the contract and that's the term that it had, but it's because it had that long a term, I'm assuming, you're more expert than me, explain how I'm wrong. I'm assuming it had that really long term because it was an investment contract and not just a pure power purchase agreement. Is that right?
I think that's right. And I think it's also, but I don't think it's entirely fair to say it is such a long term. The commission did impose a limitation here. A 10-year limitation on the Prairie State.
I'm talking about the hydropower one that's 50, 57. I can't keep all these numbers.
Yeah, it does go.
I'm assuming that's abnormally long for an arm's length power purchase agreement. And so that must have been, it was so long in part because they were investing as an ownership interest. And that tends to run longer.
Well, I think.
Can run forever as long as the entity exists sometimes.
What the commission was doing here, priority number one was to protect the reliance interests, whether it was done by through a contract, a power purchase agreement, or if it was done through some sort of investment. an investment in a coal.
Did FERC articulate somewhere, and I may have just missed it, exactly how they defined reliance interests? Any type of economic reliance interest, or were these reliance interests tied to merger concerns, power purchase, transmission access, access to their transmission system, or access to their power? Did they define more carefully what the reliance interest is? Because that seems to be some of the issue here.
I think it's the latter. It was the commission said it called it reasonable reliance and rejected the argument that
that doesn't tell me the scope of reliance, right? Because I wouldn't have gotten married if I know all these economic things were going to happen, and I wouldn't have the funds now that I thought I would have because I have to spend it on pancaking fees instead of buying, you know, and taking care of my new family. And surely FERC's not talking about that type of reliance interest. There has to be some boundaries to it.
Well, I suppose that I think we can derive what the commission did. We can derive an answer from what the commission did. The commission looked at the timeline of what had gone on here, and in addition to that, looked at the filings by Princeton and Paducah in this case that stated that they had relied on the both starting number one with the mitigation contained in the merger order, membership in MISO, and number two. And it's where we started with this, with the rate schedule 402 itself, which utilities submitted to the commission with purpose of complying with the merger order. So in those dates, a couple of those dates I want to highlight for your honor is that of course the merger was in 1998. And it's the first agreement that Princeton and Paducah have isn't until 2005. And I just want to emphasize that that was not necessarily a binding contract for their interest in Prairie State. And it's not until after rate schedule 402 became actually on file, accepted by the commission in June of 2007 when they filed a firm contract. And I think the commission was on firm ground in looking at that timeline and saying by June of 2007 that was a reasonable reliance on the contract.
Can I ask you about, I'm sorry, did you want to?
No, thank you.
The consideration of rates.
Yes.
So the commission actually in the original merger agreement in 98, the 1998 decision has a whole section of the effect of the merger on rates. Now there had been protections put in place already, you know, as part of the agreement, but FERC was looking at the effect on rates and concerned about that in particular, as one of the things in particular at the time of the merger. And it seems to me, and we know that effect on rates is, so it was looked at in 1998 as a concern with this merger, consistent with the regulation. I couldn't find a case where FERC is applying the public interest standard in this merger context, and its regulation applies, and where someone raised material evidence about a significant impact on rates and FERC refused to consider it. Can you tell me such a case?
Can't. But the commission's stated here there have been cases where rates have been discussed and those weren't an issue. And the commission clarified that in an order supplemental under subsection B of the statute, that you always look back to the reason the measure was there in the first instance. And it's admit that that's a reasonable interpretation of the edit.
So that was a change because prior to that, including in a prior case involving Louisville, in my shorthand Louisville, for all those Louisville and Kentucky utilities, they had just done it there. They did it in 2018 in Westar, and they did it in Emera, Maine, looking at rates. The regulation said to do it. You had significant evidence here. Now, FERC can have its analysis of it, but there's significant evidence propounded and a real concern about rates. I'm talking about longer term rates here. And FERC said, we're not going to look. Did it acknowledge that it was changing its position and address the reasonableness of that change other than saying we're just changing what we look at?
Well, the commission explained its position to be sure, and I guess number one, I would push back that this is a change. The commission didn't exactly agree with that, and while rates have been mentioned in some orders, I guess I would argue that was dicta. Those cases did not stand for the proposition that you had.
Agencies and their analyses have dicta like courts do. And that is, and they were addressing it. They thought it was a factor to, now they can say, we would look at rates and here no one disputes there's a problem about rates, but that says that rates are something we look at and here we agree with the parties, it's not an issue. That's still making rates relevant, right? As in the lower case.
I'm not sure that's right, Your Honor. The commission didn't, we also don't know of a case that says the converse.
No, but you've got a regulation that says, here's what public interest means in the merger context specifically, in 203 context, right? Here's what public interest means. And we're generally going to consider it. So you've got a regulation that says, this is what we expect we'll be doing. Maybe something will come up sometime and we won't, but this is our general rule. And then you have someone come in with very substantial evidence and they say, we're not going to do what our regulation says is our general rule. We're not going to do what we've done in other cases, which is address the prong. Maybe it's a quick check the box because it's not in dispute. We're just not even going to, we're cutting that prong out of the analysis. That's what they said here. We're cutting it out. And they're doing that in a case where they said, we're going to look what bothered us with the original merger. And one of the things that they addressed at the time of the original merger was rates. So those three things together leave me very confused as to why they weren't spending more time, why they sort of closed their eyes and said we refuse to consider rates in this context.
So as you say, Your Honor, the rates were discussed in the merger order, and but there's no suggestion whatsoever that the issue here today has anything to do with that discussion. Those that rate discussion is in the record, and but it has nothing to do with the litigation here.
Mr. Edinger, Judge Millett mentioned the Louisville Gas case, and I don't think I heard your response to her question about that case.
The commission explained that to the extent that was it explained why the analysis here should harken back to the analytical framework set up by the merger order, and the commission explained that because the mitigation here only has to do with competitiveness prong, that's should be the sole consideration. The commission ended its discussion. I'm trying to find. This is
the rehearing. You're talking about Louisville Gas now. Is that what you're talking about?
It ended its discussion by saying the Louisville case, and this is the 2011 case, if I...
Yes, 2011.
To the extent that was inconsistent, then it clarified here that the right way to approach an order supplemental is to look back at the original order and to consider why the mitigation is there in the first place and consider it that way. The discussion about rates in the merger order, there's no relationship between that discussion, those matters, and the mitigation at issue.
Well, it's because mitigation things were already in place for rates, right? It wasn't though that they said that doesn't matter. We only care about competition as an end in itself. It's that there were already redress was already in place that FERC blessed.
That's right, and those.
Right, so it considered it a relevant factor
which is its general policy
at the original time of the merger.
At the time of the merger, but this is a different animal. This is a different case that we're considering here. And
where has FERC before said that competition is an end in itself, all by itself, as opposed to where I look elsewhere, when commission to me has said what public interest means. They want competition, but for a reason, to have plentiful supplies of electricity at reasonable prices. They've said time and again, it's the supply at reasonable prices. So that's ultimately what the public interest is here. And it sounds to me like what the commission did here was say, you know, we don't care about reasonable prices as long as there is competition as an end in itself. And we aren't going to look at the long term. We're not going to look at the long term. And that seems to me just quite a sharp departure, both from the regulatory text and precedent, and an unusual vision of what their job and the public interest at stake here is.
Again, I think the answer to that is to look back at the framework that was set up by the merger order, and that it set up the reason that the mitigation is here. Reading these orders, there's no way to link the mitigation to other factors like the regulation and rates or any of the other matters under the statute.
And the other thing that kind of whipsawed me about the decision was they say we're only going to look at the original, what it defined then as the original merger concerns is this competition concern. But then it went on and put this whole transition mechanism that has nothing to do with that competition concern. Now, I assume the whole point of the transition mechanism was to serve the public interest, right? They deemed that to be in the public interest?
Correct.
So that seems to contradict the first half of their decision where it says the only public interest we're looking at this stage is the merger, why we had the merger conditions that we had, the very original concern about requirements, customers. That's the only public interest. And then you turn the page and they've got, it's not even listed in their regulation. They've got this whole conception of reliance interests as public interests that they're serving. And I understand why reliance interests could be part of the public interest that FERC gets to enforce. I don't think anyone has challenged that here at that level. But it seems to me that FERC has a very sharp break in its conception of the public interest in the middle of its decision. If it really only concerns about competition, there'd be no protection for reliance interests. So it recognizes that it's protecting a bigger public interest, just not rates. How can that make sense?
The commission, of course, does acknowledge that the change in what's happening here with the end of the de-pancaking, that rates will go up, that the customers will have to pay for MISO transmission, whereas they didn't before. But I don't think there's anything unusual in the commission looking at reliance and choosing a proper method to implement its change. There wasn't a time frame that was set before on the mitigation, and I think the commission here reasonably determined as part of its public interest analysis that an abrupt change for customers would not be fair.
I understand. I'm not disputing that at all. What I'm saying is that means that in the first part of the opinion, FERC straitjacketed itself. The only public interest that's relevant at this section 203 modification stage, not the original merger stage, but the modification of order stage, the only public interest that's relevant is the one that animated FERC's imposition, not self-imposed, but FERC's imposition of merger conditions. That's all we look at. That's what I'm pointing out to you, is that difference. When the next page, they said, actually, there's more public interest we're going to advance here. That's where do they say, we think it's fine to look at a general public interest and explain that transition from we're straitjacketed, there's only one public interest, to actually, we're going to look at a very broad public interest.
I would just say, Your Honor, to that there are two separate questions. The first question is
what public interest they enforce for Section 203 modification requirements would seem to be one question. Define the public interest that you enforce. That's what they seem to be answering in the first one. Quite clearly and expressly, it is only the original merger conditions. And to the extent anything was inconsistent, we're clarifying. We are clarifying that this is all we look at. And turn the page and look at something totally different.
I think the way to read these orders is that the mitigation is not needed to serve the original purpose of, to address the commission's original concerns about mitigation, about competition in the 1998 merger, full stop. And then we get to the secondary question of how do we implement that? And in this case, the commission was confronted with an issue of reliance, that folks had relied on these measures going forward and implemented a, and therefore, based on that, the commission recently implemented the transition mechanism. I see.
Were you done with that line of questions?
I am done. I'm done.
I just have one question for you, Mr. Ottinger. Regarding the transition agreement, the transition mechanism with respect to power agreements that use MISO for backup supply, at page 76 of your brief, you say, quote, municipals do not explain how they could have relied on depacking mitigation when they entered into contract for power not originating in MISO. That's what you say at page 76. But the petitioners give an example of just that in their blue brief, the Ashwood solar facility. They give that as an example of exactly where that happened. What's your response to that?
Well, that Ashwood is not in MISO. It is, It is not in MISO, and it does not rely on MISO facilities. And where the commission had to make judgment calls in this case, and one of them
I thought they said that it does rely on backup supply from MISO. No.
Well, that's the question, Your Honor. And to my knowledge, there isn't a power purchase contract that we could tie to the hydro in. Or excuse me, the Ashwood in the utilities region. If there were, that would be something that could be, if it had been in a place on the date of the March 2019 order, it could be covered. But my understanding is there is not an actual power purchase agreement for backup power. And as for
Did they have a transmission reservation for that?
They might.
Ashwood?
Then
why wouldn't that be reasonable reliance as well? It's another aspect of this contract, of this power purchase arrangement.
But it's not. It's not. There is not a. They could have a contract that the commission would have some. There could be some more certainty in defining the transition mechanism. But my knowledge, there isn't a contract that would be reliance if the municipals had a contract that they could point to that they actually signed, and it might. Be better evidence of reliance in this case.
I thought for transmission service reservations that there were contracts and FERC refused to consider those and treat them the same as power purchase agreements, even though they are sort of, they're part of a package that someone uses, sets up. You know, it's too complicated a world just to have a contract with one person to give you your stuff. They purchase these as part of that very arrangement, and yet FERC refused to consider them.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The commission did include transmission service reservations, but only to the extent of the underlying contract.
Right, but there is a real contract there that was made in reliance on this deep pancake system, and it's a mechanism for them getting power. And Congress sort of, what do I keep saying, this commission, exhibit power.
And I think
that cut them off sort of midstream or partway through. You only get half the contract, even though it was a contract, they say, made in reliance under the very conception of reliance FERC applied here.
But they are covered to the extent of that there's an actual power purchase agreement.
I understand that, but the contract isn't covered in full. And why
the reservation isn't.
Sorry?
The reservation isn't covered in full.
Yes.
That is true.
Just to be crystal clear, there's a power arrangement and there's a reservation, a transmission service reservation, which I should think is its own contract. Is that not right?
I think that's right, yes.
Its own contract with its own term.
Right.
So what I'm trying to get, and I'm sorry if I'm not being clear, and I get you're saying we'll give you 50, 60%, whatever part overlaps with this separate power purchase agreement. But that's what I'm trying to say, why does it get treated as sort of a hybrid like that instead of just recognized as a full-fledged contract entered into reliance, and it's part of how they're going to get power at this time of this deep handcaking system?
I think it's a call.
Why is it not reliance for the full, I'm sorry, just to be clear, because I know we're confusing, we've kept you up for a while. Why is that not reliance, the same type of reliance at Congress for the full term of the transmission reservation contract? Why is that not protected reliance?
Because what the commission is trying to do here is to be sensitive to the actual power purchase agreements and arrangements that the customers have done here. And I guess my answer to Your Honor's question is that just doesn't fall into that category. It's not
because if
the customers really needed that reservation, there would be an underlying agreement. There would be some sort of power purchase agreement underlying it. And here.
Well, it's not like they're gonna stop getting power. I guess I'm confused about FERC's rationale or its definition. I've remained confused throughout this as to how they're defining what reliance counts and what doesn't. They thought these weren't entered in good faith.
I don't want to say that. I would just refer your honor to the make sure I refer your honor to the commission's on this, and they address this in the 2019 rejection order, and they say that the transmission service reservations are not by themselves should be protected, and they could be used for future power purchase arrangements, which would just even further perpetuate the mitigation that the commission had determined in the first place. Is
so the concern was, so we got, I've got my contract say for 10 years, five of it's gonna overlap with an existing power purchase agreement that I can point to. And so the concern was whatever the other 5 years of the transmission contract I have are gonna be used for some future contract that's not supposed to be protected by this, this sort of final deep handcaking protections, reliance protections, because those, because of the timing, right? Because there wasn't a contract at the time of the FERC's decision.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And the commission's theory here is to return to a market that's no longer being skewed by the deep handcaking arrangement.
Right. Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Narani, you can take 2 minutes, and I wish you would, in future, not shake or nod your head. It is distracting and it's also improper.
Sorry, Your Honor. I'd like to address a few things. Just turning first to Mr. Ettinger, I'm, to be honest, confused about whether FERC is now saying they made a change to its policy on ignoring rate impacts or whether this is just consistent with previous policy, because if it is a change, which it sounds like it is now, then FERC needs to explain that change, and FERC hasn't. So I think if you look at FERC's past practice, that has always considered all the relevant public interest factors. FERC is now saying they're not going to do that anymore. That is a change to past practice, and FERC has to explain it. FERC hasn't. Mr. Clement talked about He said if his clients had established rate schedule 403, then this case would be different. They in fact did establish rate schedule 403 for the and rate schedule 404 for the Illinois and the Indiana municipals, right? They gave depancaking to lots of entities. In fact, as the even rate schedule 402 points out, it applies to future requirements customers too. So the fact that the Louisville Gas combined the requirements customers plus Owensboro plus Princeton and Paducah into the same agreement and left Illinois and Indiana to other agreements actually just confirms that Louisville Gas understood they had to provide depancaking to everybody, both existing and future customers, to protect against depancaking. And finally, we want to clarify two things. Your Honor, I said we did, Judge Millett, I said we did comment about the details of the Joppa plant. That's at JA 1026. 1026 is where we explained that to FERC in our
Is that your rehearing or request. Original? That's your rehearing?
That is the rehearing request. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's footnote 47 on that page. And I just wanted to clarify, when I talked about this, the 100 megawatt reservation, which is in fact a commitment, 38 megawatts of that is reserved for Benham and Berea until their existing power supply contracts end in 24. It's the remaining 62 that is not protected under the transition agreement that is used currently for backup and economy energy. And to respond to Mr. Ettinger's point about whether that's there's evidence that we are using it, a contract was entered after March 2019 for economy energy that uses that pipe. But the important thing is that that second purchase was only possible because we had the transmission reservation already. It's the transmission reservation itself that is proof we were relying on.
You agree that new contract wouldn't be covered, right? Don't you agree that new contract wouldn't be one that would be subject to the prior the schedule 402 or the prior system because it was post 2019?
Right, so, that's right.
I mean, so then why should the transmission part of that arrangement be covered?
Because the transmission arrangement was made before March 2019.
I know, but it wasn't paired up with any actual power agreement. So who knows? I mean, their whole rationale is we got to cut it off somewhere, and transmission by itself without power purchase tied to it is sort of just inchoate ability to get power. I know why they do it. It makes perfect business sense, I'm sure. But it's not what they're protecting. You have to have, I guess they want to say you have to have both halves to be protected. And what's I get there may have been some reliance here. What's unreasonable about them drawing the reliance line at that point?
Because it doesn't achieve the goal that they articulated, which is to protect the financial commitments we made in advance.
Right. I guess they never defined reliance very well. So.
And quickly, one last point. On the length of power purchase agreements, the Ashwood Solar power purchase agreement is for 20 years. I did pull up the contract, it's not on the record, but the contract with the hydro units is actually called a power sales contract between American Municipal Power and Princeton and Paducah. It is, I think the reason it's sort of referred to as an ownership interest is because there was an upfront payment, but it has a fixed term. So if the project lasts beyond 36 years, Princeton and Paducah have no rights to it. So it is a power purchase agreement for 36 years, but it's a big upfront payment and it's called a power sales contract.
All right, Mr. Clement, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points in rebuttal. Just to clarify, it may be that Ashford had a 20-year term, but of course that's not a grandfathered contract because that doesn't get benefit from depancaking ever. So of the power purchase agreements that are issued here, the longest one does run till 2029. It's obviously just a horse of a completely different color to extend this thing to 2057 as to the hydros. And maybe this was just loose language, but my friend from FERC talked about, he used the phrase reliance, protecting reliance is priority number one. With all due respect, that's not even what they said. They said they were balancing the interest in protecting Reliance interests with moving on to the current market that no longer needs the pancaking. And so I think, you know, maybe it was priority number one in extending this to 2057, but that's not making a reasonable balance of competing interests. That's sort of extending sort of Reliance to the utmost. And I don't think they did that in other places. I think this transmission reservation that was discussed is a good example of that. With respect to the transmission capacity reservation that's not associated with particular contracts, FERC reasonably said, you know, that could be used with new contracts. And we want to get out of the de-pancaking business in this market. And so we're going to reasonably cut it off there. I think they needed to make a similar judgment with respect to these hydro projects. With respect to Prairie States, they specifically said,
why wasn't it reasonable just to say, we're going to look at the term of the contract that was entered into at the time of de-pancaking. And the term of the hydropower one was, I'm sorry, was it 57 years, 60 years, something like that. That's the term. And we're not going to pick these things apart and analyze whether there was some quasi-investment angle to it or not. That would be a hard thing for them to dive into as well, wouldn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I guess what I would say is it's not really balancing Reliance interests against moving forward to just identify the outer perimeter of a Reliance interest. I mean, to say you entered in the contract and it lasted 2057, that doesn't actually identify reasonable Reliance. It identifies the outer universe of Reliance. And I think part of the reason that's not reasonable when it goes that far is because nobody reasonably thinks the regulatory environment's not going to change for 50 years, for 5 years, for 7 years.
I think you said your client, it's not in the record, so I take it your client did not put in information before FERC about what the average length of arm's length power purchase agreements are. So how do I know? I mean, I hear you. To me, it sounds like a long period of time, but how do I know that that's not sort of a reasonable length for a power purchase agreement? And that's what they said they were going to protect, and they get a lot of deference.
Well, I think as evidenced by the way they treated the hydro plants, they actually ended up saying, we're going to protect any agreement, whether it's power purchase or investment, no matter how long it lasts. And we didn't put in evidence as to the average length of either set because—
They didn't say any agreements. We know that with the transmission service reservations, they didn't do any agreement that was entered before the date of the agreement in 2019. They just once it, if it's a hard written down, we can read a power purchase agreement. And I don't know that that's not average. I understand your arguments, and it certainly feels like a long time, but I don't have any evidence that tells me that's not average.
Well,
it's not normal.
Two points, Your Honor. I don't mean to quibble, but with respect even to the transmission reservation, they protected the contract for the life of the contract. They just cut it essentially in half. But they did recognize the basic principle that if you entered a contract, we're going to honor it. Our point, which doesn't depend on average lengths, is that there is a radical difference between saying you reasonably relied that the regulatory climate wouldn't change for 50 years versus 5 or 7. And that happens to correspond to the length of investments versus the length of power purchase agreements. It corresponds perfectly on this record. And if there were a unusual power purchase agreement that lasted until 2057, I would still be telling you it's not reasonable to treat that the same as a contract with a 2 or a 7 year tail. The last point, if I just could, is on this idea that I think FERC explained exactly what they were doing here with respect to this merger condition, and what they did is entirely reasonable. If you have a merger mitigation condition that is designed to address one of the three factors they considered in 1998, and then you are deciding whether it's necessary or still appropriate, of course you consider the original merger condition that it was designed to address, and you don't reopen the whole kettle of fish. So yes, back in 1998, they were concerned about rates. They put in conditions like LG&E shouldn't raise its transmission rates for 5 years, which would have expired in 2003. You can't use just reopening the one thing that goes to competition to reopen the whole kettle of fish and go back and reimpose rate restrictions or the rest. And it's particularly true here because in order to address a market-related concern, we agreed to something that artificially lowered rates. So removing that, of course, is going to increase rates by that amount. And that's irrelevant to what this was in there for in the first instance. So with all due respect, I think FERC handled this exactly right. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Madam Clerk, if you would please close court.